Another podcast, Pearl Droid, episode 69. My name is Russell. I'm on my own today, but I have the pleasure via Skype of Mr. Mark Ainsbury. How are you, Mark?
Yeah, good, Russ. How are you?
Yeah, I'm grand. I'm really grateful for your time. We've already been talking kind of off air for a few minutes, just plotting and planning what we're going to cover, and we're both worried that we might still be here in the wee hours.
Yeah, I'm up for it.
we could do a whole season, some sort of Netflix series style season of these things, because I reckon you've probably got a ton of tales to tell.
Well, I'm old enough, Russell, and I've been around enough. Some of it I've forgotten because I was there, if you see what I mean. But yeah, there's been a lot of nostalgia recently on Twitter and other social media platforms about how great some of the now legendary Wales away games were in the 80s and 90s, and how that sort of took us on what became a roller coaster ride to France, and the fact that now our Wales away family, in a good way, is bigger and probably more diverse. There's probably more women and kids going now, and it's just got bigger and better. But yeah, thinking about what it was like in those days and seeing some of the pictures that we've all got on developed down boots, it looks like it was hundreds of years ago, some of it, and especially some of the clothes that we were wearing. So yeah, there's plenty to talk about, and that's before we get on to any of the football itself, which is the football was often, or nearly always, incidental, to be honest.
Yeah, some of the haircuts and the shell suits didn't really need to be seen again, did they?
Exactly. So when there's been stuff going around of favourite Wales away pictures, some of them have been a mixed blessing, including one that came out today of me in Albania in 1995, and everyone's been talking about Albania in the last week or so because we're going there again. There's a picture of me with my arm around, literally around the shoulders of Bobby Gould. yeah, that's a horror picture for me. One thing I thought at the start, before we start talking about what games we went to and what it's been like, is I was reflecting upon the first time that you and I met each other, and it was only sometime last year after watching a film.
Yeah,
we didn't know each other, were there Chapter, and the very fact that we'd been in to Chapter in Cardiff to watch a film about Wales in the football would 2 years previously have been absolutely unbelievable. We dragged some kids in. I'm not sure the kids we were with were even our kids, were they, to be honest? We just dragged some kids in to make you look more respectable, and we dragged them off the streets on a Sunday afternoon and went and watched the film.
Yeah.
And your immortal opening line to me, you looked me up and down, if you don't mind me saying so, and you said, oh, you're taller than I thought, which is a reference to Podcast Bell Droid previous episodes, I think, where Simon Shakeshaft, who's a good friend of mine, it implied to you that I might be so short that I could be Brian Flynn's stunt double. So when you saw me in real life, and I'm actually about 5'7", you know, I think you thought I was going to be literally a dwarf. So that was an interesting, interesting few seconds.
Yeah, yeah. There's a sort of podcast in joke there as well, isn't there? But yeah, no, it was. And yeah, you're right. I must confess, I didn't drag someone else's children. I took my eldest along, who he kind of enjoyed it, but was a bit bored after a while, just watching kind of semi-drunk and drunk people indulging.
Well, there we are. So
themselves.
I'll tell you, in that viewing of that film that afternoon, there was half dads and half kids, and I, for a fact, the only ones who cried in there were the dads. And we've seen the film a few times by then. And the only ones who cheered when the goals went in were the dads as well. And we knew every scene of that film and lapped it up all the more for that. Even the fact that we have a film is let alone that we went to the semi-finals in that film, it was just astonishing thing that any of us could ever have imagined. So there we are.
It was the screening of Nick Stradlin's, or AKA Movies Wales, on Twitter, so Wales in the Movies on YouTube, his film The Red Wall of Al Gore, and he did a sort of like a Q&A about it. And yeah, and people who hadn't met each other prior to that, there was a couple of other people I met for the first time and have bumped into sort of numerous times at local games down here. And yeah, like you said, it's part of that big family, and I agree with you, it is more diverse. I think one of the great things about the sort of Twitter thing tonight, actually, which has been perfect timing, actually, and really complements the sort of the nostalgia, the shameless nostalgia, unapologetic nostalgia fest that this is going to be, I suspect, is the Barry Horns putting out the the tweet around, you know, the greatest ever Wales away photos with the hashtag Wales away photo. And, you know, there's been tons back. But I put one out with some guys. I'm assuming they're from Bute Town in Cardiff. And they've got this flag and it's at the Northern Ireland game. And it's this Somaliland Welsh Warriors flag. And
yeah.
I think if nothing else, without kind of wanting to make them sort of poster boys for something they're probably not going to claim to be. But I think that, to an extent, reflects that inclusivity and that diversity and tolerance. But they're also having a good laugh, and you know that's got to be part of this as well. You know, it's been a nice little hors d'oeuvre to what we were hoping to discuss tonight.
Yeah, while you're talking about Twitter, if anyone wants to catch up with me after, and some of my blogs that we're going to talk about are on there. I'm at Chasing the Dragon, chasing without an A in it.
One of the things we always do when we get people on is we kind of ask them what was their first memory or their first kind of conscious, you know, awareness of what this little old country on the very periphery of Western Europe with rubbish weather. What was the first memory of a national team for you?
So I was born in Pontypridd and I was brought up in Taswell, and I was born in 67, so I'm 50 now. And our house in Taswell was literally next to the railway line. So on Saturdays, I would habitually see Cardiff City fans going down on the trains for big games. I always associated that with glamour and excitement and maybe a bit of naughtiness, and just the whole thought of going to the football was something for me as a really young lad that was just always there as what I wanted to be part of, and that these people who went were just, you know, the most glamorous creatures in the world. In terms of the national team, then when I was 9 is when we played Yugoslavia in that ultimately ill-fated quarterfinal of the European Championships. One of my family had bumped into someone who'd been to the match and brought the programme home from that match. That, to me, was my first physical, I wasn't allowed to go to the game, my first physical piece of being part of that thing that I just, even as a 9-year-old boy, I was absolutely obsessed with. And now as a 50-year-old boy, frankly, if you speak to anyone who's been to a match with me, I'm still equally obsessed. That ardour, that passion has not dimmed with experience or with age. It's got worse, probably. Not worse, it's got better, probably. So, yeah, that was 76, and I hadn't gone to a game. And then 2 days before my 10th birthday was Anfield, and I didn't go to that for obvious reasons. That was legendarily quite rough for Wales fans at Anfield. And, of course, we know what that eternal cheat Joe Jordan did, and he made me cry 2 days before my 10th birthday, for which I've never forgiven him, because I was still crying on my birthday. And, frankly, about him, I'm still crying now, because he was unrepentant. And that's one of those things that people say to us all the time, don't they? Oh, you know, can't you let it go? It was all those years ago, blah, 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 blah. But of course, we'll never let it go, and we'll never forgive him. So that was 77. And then one of the most impossibly thrilling nights of my whole life, I got taken to see Wales play for the first time on my 14th birthday, and against Iceland, at the Vetch, October the 14th, 1981. Yeah, in quite a fitting metaphor, really, for most of the rest of my Wales watching career. It was an evening of farce, comedy, tragedy, and miserable failure. So that's all the ingredients I needed, really. I was hooked from then. I'll never forget, we were in the East Stand, that weird half stand at the Vetch. We were in the top tier of that, and I'll never forget walking up and seeing the bright green of the turf and the lights, just the technicolour, almost like sensory overload of the whole experience. And there were these gods in front of me. These were my gods. And if you look at the team that played that night, it's astonishing. Maybe the team that played that night for Wales would beat the current Wales team, you know, because we had an astonishing array of stars. But as everyone knows, we had the floodlight failure, so Iceland came from behind. We went 1-0 up, I think, and then they went 2-1 up, and then we equalised, and a draw secured our elimination, effectively, from the 1982 World Cup, when we should have qualified. So that was probably the first of the coulda, shoulda, woulda qualified that we saw in the following decades. Maybe it's like this for everyone when you go to your first game, especially as a child. I was 14. It's the things around it, the incidental things. It's the noise, the singing. That night there was some trouble outside afterwards, which I'm not condoning, but it was, wow, you're not supposed to see those things. And so everything went together, really, and we were wearing that beautiful Adidas kit, and just to see all that stuff up close, I just wanted more of it straight away. That was it, and I was hooked for life, even more than I already had been. For notorious reasons, yeah, it was a classic night in the history of Welsh football. And we sat in Block B, seats 4 and 5. I can still remember every. I can remember every detail and every incident about that evening. So that was it. I felt like I was just mainlining Wales, and I just wanted more and more of it. I couldn't get enough of it.
Wow, even remember the seats.
Yeah, I can remember every detail about everything. Because my eyes were on Storks, because I'd wanted this for so long, and then for various reasons I wasn't able to go, and then we went, and I was 14, and that was it. And then for the next few years, I didn't go to an away game. Well, my first away game was in 91 in Belgium, when we drew 1-1, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But for the 80s, I was just able to go to home games, so I went to home games all over Wales, really. Don't forget, throughout that decade, we had some of the best players that we've ever seen grace our shirt, you know, with Hughes, Ratcliffe, Saunders, Southall, all these, like, gods, like, real footballing gods, most of whom would get into the current side. If you did a composite all-time Wales best 11, a lot of those boys would be in there, notwithstanding the recent sort of unprecedented success. So, yeah, it was a great time to be able to go. And I remember from then that football always had, I alluded to it a minute ago about this sort of the glamour or the, you know, it was a bit dodgy, it was a bit sleazy, it was what the cool kids did. It wasn't establishment, it was counter-establishment, counter-culture, had good music attached to it. There could be trouble. I don't mean like hooliganism, but you could just, stuff was going to happen at any moment. And, like, it was just that. It was just the glamour and the noise and the colour of it. And that was it. I knew I never wanted to do anything else.
Leon, our comrade off here, wrote a blog probably 2 years ago now. I think it was before the Euros, about how following Wales in a footballer has kind of gone, or at that point was getting mainstream. I suppose what he did in that piece was contrast now, and you alluded it to, mentioned it earlier in terms of, you know, bigger family, etc. It's contrasting it with those sort of days where it's smaller crowds, it's ramshackle grounds, you know, a bit of the trouble and all the rest of that. I can imagine it would have been very heady, very intoxicating.
Yeah, it was. And when I started going to away games, so now the people of my generation, and there we are. So those people, I've made a dozen of the best friends in the whole of my life through that, you know, that coterie of lads, really. And some of them had started going to away games before me, maybe because they're a bit older or whatever. So late 80s, everyone talks about when we played in Cologne in 89, maybe, or in Nuremberg. Probably that was 1990, I think. Was that Ryan Giggs' debut? And then 91, we played in Brussels away. All these places, well, wherever these places were, even Belgium, Germany, so-called Western Europe, all these places were quite hard to get to because there was no internet, there was no cheap flights. There was no nothing. We just had the trains we were standing in. It was hard to get anywhere, which made it more intrepid and more of an adventure. And by the way, when you got there, one, it took so long to get there that you had a good time on the way. And when you got there, you tucked into it with even more gusto. So going to Belgium away, like, in there, played Belgium away 3 times in the 90s, that was the first of them. And, like, there were thousands of Wales fans there. That night, I just walked into the goal. I got there, like, the day before, and we were just mingling and drinking the really too strong for us Belgian beer. And, you know, there was rumours that lads were getting deported. Like, lots of Wales fans got deported before the game, mainly due to the heavy-handed, like, Belgian police. So there was this air of, you know, something was going on that night, and something was in the air. And I walked into the ground, and I don't know literally how many Wales fans were there that night, but, I mean, probably it felt like about 20,000. It might have been about 3,000. And we were supposed to get hammered, and we were wearing that beautiful Chevron Umbro away top, which is still my favourite Wales top of all time, and we got a draw. When Dean Saunders scored, it went absolutely mental. In Pulp Fiction, you know that scene where Uma Thurman gets injected with adrenaline and in the middle of her chest and just, like, goes from basically dead to completely out of the roof? That night for me was like that. It was like being injected with drugs, because everything just became much bigger. This is all I wanted to do at that point, is follow Wales away. That was it. Because all I've ever wanted to do in my life is play football for Wales, right? That's true to this day, and I still haven't given up the hope. But going and watching us play away, that's like representing Wales. That's like you being called up, or you've called yourself up, and you've gone to this moderately difficult to get to place where, and some of them were really difficult to get to, and you were part of it, and you were representing, as as you said earlier, our small, often patronised, often dismissed, beautiful country in these far-flung places. And we were really proud of that. We all stuck together. We all got to know each other and you know, to really like each other. And then we started going to some really far-flung, what you could call communist or what had recently stopped being communist countries, you know, behind the Iron Curtain and all that stuff. And at the time, I did some fanzine articles, really. I found them about a few months ago, and they got put on Twitter and on my blog. So if anyone wants to see that, you can look at my Twitter or Ralph there, at Ralph Davis. But they've been lost, and those articles now, having finding them now, made them much more evocative of kind of like a lost or a different era. And at that time, and that was another thing about the era, because Wales, like the Welsh club scene, and there were a couple of national ones, had a really vibrant fanzine culture. Mm. So there was 5 to 3 coming out of Pwllheli from Dylan Llewellyn. There were, and he did Twtian Pob as well. There was Intifada coming out of Cardiff with Simon Johnson and others. Phil Stead, I think, was involved in that. Guy Lempermurtha was one of the originals and is still going, obviously, under the tutelage of Mark Evans and his friends. You know, and they were really influential in that whole thing about the culture and seeing ourselves as being different to the mainstream, a bit cooler, well, quite a lot cooler, to be honest. And that whole thing about following Wales into these places that you showed me on a map, well, you wouldn't know where to put them, like who knew where Moldova was, who knew where Romania was, Albania, if we're talking about Albania last week, because we're playing them. Yeah, it was really bloody hard to get to Albania in 1995, and it was quite hard to get out of there at the end of those were the things that really bound us together. And another thing, so the Welsh FA now has become, for better or for worse, mainly for the better, of course, has become a much more professional outfit, and not least because the people who work there now are fans and care about the team and care about us, the fans, as well. But in those days, the Welsh FA was largely a venal, unhelpful shambles, and tales of Wales fans being refused boarding onto the players' plane at Stansted on a flight to Minsk to play Belarus. They chucked the fans off the plane because so that they could get more FAW councillors onto the plane. Those things were funny, and those things are classic stuff, but they serve to show that we've come a long way since then.
Don't imagine it was funny at the time, if you were the one left on the tarmac.
To be fair, I think it was people like including Gwilym Ac Rhys Bôr, legendary Wales fans, or self-styled legendary Wales fans to this day, and I think they found it absolutely hilarious, to be honest. I remember Gwilym, who's not a natural Daily Mail constituent, pining in the Daily Mail. It's really sad because Wales, our national team, the only thing that brings a bit of meaning into our otherwise drab existences. Hmm. So I think he found it absolutely hilarious, to be honest. But yeah, I didn't go on that one, so I didn't get chucked off the bay.
But, I mean, you mentioned farce earlier in respect to that Iceland game, and I guess that's sadly never been too far away, and we've shot ourselves in the foot any number of times, both on and off the field. But like you said, off air, we've touched on this previously with people, sometimes the game presumably is a sideshow?
Well, I wouldn't say a sideshow. I'd say more like a crushing disappointment. But if you find that to be a sideshow, then yeah, that's your term. The thing is, right, let's not forget this, right? Until about six months before then, when we started seeing it with the win at home against Belgium, maybe the win away in Cyprus, we all knew we'd never qualify, right? We didn't come to Wales, home or away, for the glory, did we? Or for the, no. You know, for the endless editions of another star on our shirts and stuff. We came just for the laugh with our mates. We knew we'd never qualify. We sing about it, don't we? Like, we knew. It's not about the qualification. It's not about the result. It's about representing your country. It's about going away and having a laugh with your mates and just doing ridiculous things, really. Of course, when we did fail to qualify, when we got close, like, say, in 93 or in 2003 against Romania and Russia, of course, the fact that the qualification was within our grasp and arguably we should have done it both times made it worse, but it never put us off. Like, if I'm 50 now, I would happily have carried on to 150 and never seen us qualify. Yeah, but then we did, so let's talk about that in a minute. But yeah, about going to places with your mates, that was it. And just having a proper laugh, meeting people from all over Wales. So now I've got friends from wherever. You can think of Bala, Porthmadog, Pwllheli, Ynysmon, all parts of West Wales, down through Swansea, Llanelli, Cardiff, Newport, obviously. And that's another thing that's been quite a change as well, is sometimes there would be what you could call inter-club rivalries, it would go off between various factions of fans at away games. That's died down quite a lot recently for the good. But in general, it was just all about us all over Wales getting together under one flag under the Rhaegor and just having the best time of our lives, because we weren't allowed to act like that in real life. So we just went to these weird far-flung places and just got on with it.
You mentioned the film earlier, and the one that Nick did about that weekend in Bordeaux. And there's a phrase that gets used any number of times in that by different people about Wales kind of being on the map finally. And so I'm curious, for somebody like yourself who's travelled to all of those, many of those far-flung places, well, where were we prior to the Euros then? If we're only on the map now, where were we? Were we a footnote or in the index or something? I mean, what's different, do you think, or have you experienced in terms of awareness then of Wales and its mountain people from places like Albania in the early 90s when you go in there and then now?
I think it was fairly, wider knowledge of us was minimal, wasn't it? Like, one exception was Ian Rush. I remember wherever we went in the 90s, everyone knew who Ian Rush was, maybe because he had a high profile at Liverpool and then at Juventus. Or he was such a legend. The only other player that I ever remember being mentioned to me by what you could call like a local in these places was Azerbaijan in the first one. And someone, like a barman, just kept on going on and on to me about Craig Bellamy. He didn't like him, but he knew about him and he was obsessed with Craig Bellamy. I think now, inevitably, and you know, I didn't go to China, but you saw the frenzy that there was for Bale there. Well, actually, there was a frenzy for quite a lot. There was a frenzy for Harry Wilson and Chris Gunter. So, but I just think Gareth Bale's clearly got us on the world map. That kind of speaks to something in, to talk of the other film, Don't Take Me Home. There was a bit where Martin Williams said, pointing to football being clearly the world game, and that Wales' success getting to the semis is I can't remember his exact words, but gave us higher profile and was a bigger thing than anything that the rugby team could do via the Six Nations. So I think by definition of football being the Premier League being so high profile around the world, Gareth Bale clearly playing on a higher stage or a different stage than that and winning the Champions League 3 times, elevated us into almost like global consciousness. Also, maybe we'll get onto this lecture again, but when we did qualify, well, I always said all my life, of course we'll never qualify, but if we do, I don't mind if we lose every game 6-0, because I just want us to be there. By nature of the fact that we then played with some games quite some verve, and against Slovakia, against Russia, against Belgium, we were amazing in different ways in each of those games. You know, what did we do? We scored 10 goals in that tournament, and we got to the semi-finals, and all that stuff. So that clearly, by definition, elevated us. Small chance you ever get to the semi-finals, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff. So that's put us, because clearly that's not the biggest football tournament in the world, but it is the European Championships in the biggest sport in the world. Therefore, I think that sign sealed a place in a broader public consciousness. And yet, I think that's to the credit of the players. It's also to the credit, by the way, of FAW and the way they marketed it, the way they communicated in 4 languages, based themselves in Brittany and even speaking Breton to the locals. Simple, clever, respectful stuff that actually made me feel quite proud. My second away game, we went to Romania the night we lost 5-1, and I went there by train via Hamburg, and it was one of the most arduous journeys of my life, like 30 hours on the train, where we got off the train, we got robbed within 2 minutes. We went to the players' hotel to ask for help, and they stared at us as if we were armed gunmen coming to kill them. It didn't help us at all. And the under-21s, the night before the main game, we won 3-2 at Rapid Bucharest, and there's some classic grainy pictures on the internet of, you know, the Wales fans there, and the seats were literally disintegrating when you touched them. It was a really ramshackle place. And FAW, wherever he was, head honcho, Alan Evans, got literally put against the wall outside by the Wales fans, because we found out that the tickets for the main game were like 20p and they charged us £15, and this is in 1992. So, you know, the FAW in those days were incompetent, and in PR terms, they were their own worst enemies. Now, they've gone, they haven't gone full circle, because that, you know, back where they started, they've gone half, they're completely different.
Yeah.
You know, to the credit of everyone there. So yeah, I think we've got a place on the world stage now.
I mean, it's interesting what you talk about in terms of that game in Romania. I mean, football was different. The FAW was different, but football was different. Heysel was still in recent memory. Hillsborough clearly was. And I can remember the 1990 World Cup. My first World Cup I remember is 86. And that had an exoticness about it for any number of reasons, because it was taking place at a strange time zone. And
it was in Mexico City, wasn't it? Mexico. That's the reason I failed my A-levels, because I was up all night watching that.
Yeah, so, tournament updates of players just kind of lounging by the pool and looking bronzed. And I remember collecting the stickers and being quite conscious at that point as to, well, hang on a minute, there's Scotland, there's England, there's Northern Ireland, but there's no Wales. So you learn that that's the kind of natural order of things, like you're saying, that we're never going to qualify. But that was the natural order. That's what Wales does. And but the 1990 World Cup, I was probably much more kind of conscious of. I mean, I was aware of 86, watched a lot of the games, but 1990 was much more invested and it was a little bit older. And you had all these Italian stadia that just looked, you know, out of this world and looked modern and impressive compared to the, well, I mean, you know, not to be too glib about it, death traps, literally, in the case of Hillsborough, that we had in Britain. And much as I love and I, you know, fondly look back at going to Ninian Park, I mean, it was ramshackle and by no means the worst stadium around in the early 90s. Football was a lot different and it looked a world away on the continent at Italia 90, to my mind.
So when we went to Albania in 95, we deliberately we flew to Rome and went to Bari to get a ferry from Bari to Albania. And one reason I wanted to go to Bari was because they had that astonishing stadium. I don't know if they might still play there, which they built for Italia 90, Bari Football Club, where there's probably about 40 or 30 different stands. There was just different blocks with big gaps between them.
Yeah.
Like an astonishing kind of stadium. So yeah, I just wanted to go see that in a kind of train sponsorish kind of way. But I don't really hate sitting at the football. Even if I have to watch the football in the house, I don't sit down. That's a bit weird, right? But I don't feel part of it if I'm sitting down. So I miss that about the old stadiums. I always remember when we beat Denmark at Ninian Park in the mid-80s and Mark Hughes scored. And it was just like a seething mass of people. And, you know, it was dark and it was under the floodlights. Denmark was supposed to win and we against the odds. I mean, I'm sure it led to another tale of heartbreak and failure. But, yeah, I much prefer the environment now is different, right? So you probably take your kids, I take my kids to see Wales play, and they can, you know, they can be confident that they're going to be, that they can see for a start, and that they're quite close to it, and they're going to be safe. So that's progress on balance, I would have thought.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree, on balance, yeah. And I think what's great is that at the Cardiff City Stadium, like you said, there's that proximity to the ground. There's some of the basic kind of factors that you want out of a stadium, or certainly what I want out of a stadium. But, you know, it's more than that. We could be playing with a big athletics track around it, you know, miles away from the action, but there's still that kind of bond, isn't it? And my lad is conscious of that. I'm not sure whether he thinks that's kind of like the thing and the normal, you know, that's how it is. But he is aware that, and will remark that, you know, the players, he's asked me a couple of times, why are the players clapping us? Just trying to explain, yes, it's an etiquette, it's a courtesy, but actually it does genuinely feel more than that. And it is more than that. And I think it's great that youngsters can kind of get into the game generally, but also into the national team. And it has that about it. And like you said, I think I forget the context now in which you used the term respectful. Oh, it was the way in which the FAW kind of, you know, communicated, quadrilingually during the Euros. It is, it's respectful and it's about being valued. And that, by the sounds of it, is in stark contrast to how you and others were treated back in the 90s.
I think some of that is a lot of the staff. I mean, look, Mark Evans, he's a friend of mine, by then from Earth, as he's known on social media. I've been there since probably 1990 at the FAW, and he's been my friend since probably 92. And he's been a constant thread throughout that. But at that time, for a long time after that, it appeared to me that there weren't that many people who were fans around him. It appeared to be, and excuse me if this sounds slanderous, but it was a lot about the committee members. I'm sure they do lots of good grassroots for the game all across Wales. But there weren't people in the FAW who genuinely cared. And now, to use the cliche, a lot of the players are fans as well. I mean, the arch example being Chris Gunter, you know, he's one of us. And, you know, I fully believe that if he wasn't playing for Wales, he'd be in the stand with his brother or he'd be down the pub with us. In a way, the Welsh FA got lucky, didn't they, with their Together Stronger marketing slogan. And, you know, whether you like that as a simplification of Gora Chwara, Ki Chwara, or not, like some people didn't like it because it was too trite, really. But actually, by luck or judgment, it came together for them and it kind of built a groundswell or a movement, and we did feel together. You know, and then, of course, Chris Gunter in Lawrence with his chin up, don't worry, you know, we go again next Monday, and we all know what happened the next Monday in Toulouse. Yeah, there is a genuine bond. I think the fact the players genuinely appreciate the fans, not least because we've been through all those years of failure or heightened achievement, or whatever you call it, always the bridesmaid and never quite on the big stage. And, you know, we've earned our massive success that we've managed to generate in the last couple of years. Clearly, we're not going to the World Cup. Didn't really see that coming on that Monday night, to be honest. Although I knew they would be cynical and physical, I didn't realise the extent to which that would be true. I still think we're going to come again, certainly for the next European Championships. Maybe we'll talk about that in a minute. So, yeah, the fact that we haven't qualified now, yeah, do you know what gutted me out? Right, so do you know what? So in 2016, Russell, I'm not joking, you can ask my kids, I cried a lot of times every day for 6 months just through joy. And there'd be random stuff would trigger me off. I'd just be in the car and they'd mention Wales in the football on the radio, and I'd just have to stop the car because I was crying. The thing that made me cry the most was when our Panini sticker album came out. And so the reason I'm gutted about the World Cup now is I was even more gutted a couple of weeks ago when I got the album and we're not in it. Yeah, I know we've only been in it once in my life, right? I know what the norm is, but it made me reflect how that beautiful sort of halcyon sort of 8 months that we had from the 10th of October in Venice through to the start of July in Lyon. You know, we will get success again, but you can never have your first time twice, can you?
We were semi-finalists at Euros. The last tournament in China Cup, we were runners-up. So there's a trajectory there, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a logical progression. Well done.
Yeah?
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to lifting the trophy in whichever of the European Championships 48 cities Michel Platini let us play in that stupid 2020 tournament.
The World Cup will be a poorer place without us on the pitch. It'll be a poorer place without us off the pitch, because you were one of the recipients. You made a point of saying off air that I had to emphasise that you were collecting on behalf of fans, obviously, but one of the recipients of the Fans Award for the Euros as well.
Yeah, that came about quite quickly, really. I think that was against Serbia at home last year. By the way, I would have swapped collecting the plaque on the pitch at half time for collecting 3 points at the end of the game.
Yeah.
But there we are. UEFA had awarded to Wales an award for being the best fan. So I think for bringing the most to, you know, the streets of France and the stadiums and all that stuff. I mean, clearly we had more chance to be the fans of the tournament than England did, because we were in the tournament for quite a lot longer than they were. So we just had more games. So a few of us, you know, who'd been going quite a long time, were able to go on the pitch at half-time and collect that on behalf of the whole of the Red Wall, really, all the fans who travelled. And, I mean, we're veering around a bit chronologically, aren't we? But there's some really striking things during the European Championship. You know, like Bordeaux, I was going to tell you, right, of course we're never going to qualify, but if we do, could you pick a nicer city to have your first game in than Bordeaux?
Yeah.
Imagine you'd be quite hard pushed to do that. And then the atmosphere in the town, you know, the night before, even on the train, we went by train from London, and like the train journey down, it was just the most beautiful train journey of my life. The city in the morning of the game, with, you know, Slovakia fans outnumbered by whatever factory it was, but everyone getting on friendly, all the locals loving us, it was a beautiful day. Russell, you know, one of the most amazing moments of my life, I walked into that stadium, say, like half an hour before the game, my mates, and walk up the steps, go onto the concourse, and then there's the steps up. Seriously, and you see the pitch for the first time. And it's the most striking green I've ever seen. Listen, I'd spent literally, how old was I then? 48, say. I'd spent literally 40 years since I first became conscious of it at the age of, say, 9, of dreaming, literally daydreaming. Seriously, I could have had so many more jobs than I've had if I hadn't wasted time dreaming of what it would be like, constantly, of what it would feel like to be in the stadium. This is all I wanted in my whole life. I'm not joking. The Wales to walk out. That's all I wanted. I didn't care if, like I said, I didn't care if we lost 6-0 every game. And it used to cause me quite a lot of stress, because I knew it would never happen, that calmed the stress. But I was really worried about, if that such a thing happened, would I be with my friends who I'd been going to the match with for so long? Or would I be surrounded by these corporate types or neutrals or people who didn't care, or people who just got along like to jump on a bandwagon? And when we got there, it was the most glorious scene, the first second when I saw it at the inside of the stadium. And then I was with all those people. And the other part of my daydream all my life, I knew I'd die happy if I ever saw seeing him, Lad Van Haddai, in a major tournament. Johnny Owen brings it out really well in this film, Don't Take Me Home. You know, he majors on that rendition of the anthem, because you know what happens at some matches, the music's too slow or the music's too fast or the crowd's out of time, blah, blah. It doesn't quite work somehow. That afternoon, you know, as well as I do, and I'm only saying it because it bears endless repetition. The players were crying on the pitch, and they weren't crying because they were nervous about the match. They were crying because they're so proud and they're overwhelmed by the enormity of what we've achieved. And we absolutely bellowed it. I've never heard a crowd sing an anthem. Every man, woman and child in that crowd, and don't forget we had most of the ground, not just our end, every single one. Perfect, loud, proud, incredulous. That's the best 2 moments, the best 2 minutes of my life. I said to people previously, I remember having a pitched a story with Chris Watson, formerly Wales Online, and now he's gone to BBC journalist, about, oh yeah, anyway, if that ever happens, when they've sung the anthem, we're going to walk out anyway, because nothing can top that. Well, I'm glad I stayed in the ground in Bordeaux, because guess what? Then, yet more uncharted territory, guess what? What happened after 10 minutes? We scored the goal in the major championship. And it was just beautiful. I mean, it was just crying, and we were just so proud. And let's not go into what happened in that game. But then, of course, Hal Wilson-Cardew stumbles onto a ball and it calls in the corner, in our corner, and we're all on top of each other, and the players all on top of each other. At the end, all my thing about would I be with my mates? Yeah, I was with my mates because we stayed in the ground crying our eyes out. We're grown men, we're adults. It's all we ever wanted in our life. And the fact that it matters so much to the players, and the fact that it matters so much to Cookie, and the fact that it made us reflect on Gary Speed and the journey that we've been on following what happened to him, and all that stuff, and a lot of the staff. You know, the FAW staff, like, profoundly moved by what happened that afternoon and the bond between us and the players. And then, yeah, so... Sorry, have I taken up about an hour talking about Bordeaux? And then we stayed out until 5 o'clock in the morning, eh? And bumping into people from all over Wales who just hugging each other and crying and singing, and everyone just incredulous and happy. And the people of Bordeaux to this day, and probably, you know, to the end of time, absolutely loved us. The ambassadors for our country, there we are. There's another thing. We don't sing songs about the Second World War. We sing songs about our players. And we sing songs about, I don't know, about gibberish, like shoveling snow in Norway, and just like fun, and well, yeah, just a celebration of our country and a celebration of each other, the fans. I really love, like, the fans. I just love them, you know, and some of the people that I've become friends with down the years and their families, and you know, Gary Pritchard and his family, and Anismon Dilantuele and Tommy Collins and Chris's brother, you know, the boys from down West Wales. You know, my best friend, Ralph Davis, he lives in Czech Republic now, but his life was changed by going to Moldova away in whenever that was, 94, and I went with him, and we became best friends for life on that trip. And he was working in Lloyds Bank, and he was bored, and he went to Moldova, and that was an astonishing tale in itself, that trip, because we did that one by train as well, and got arrested by mistake for 44 hours. But that changed his life, and shortly after that, he packed his job in and moved to Czech Republic, and he's been in Czech Republic for 22 years. Wales away opened his eyes to a whole new world of not working in Lloyds Bank.
He was going to write us a blog, what, 18 months ago, about what following Wales is like from the Czech Republic, where essentially every game is an away game, and he still hasn't done it, so feel free to give him a dig in the ribs.
There's no finer call than getting told to do it live or get, publicly on a podcast.
Get called out. Ralph, you've got to get this done.
I'll do it.
Genuinely, there is literally nothing else to say about that match in Bordeaux that can improve how you have emotively and emotionally captured the feelings and the sense of euphoria, the sense of achievement, the sense of relief, the camaraderie, the wanting to celebrate it with people that have shared in the disappointments and the frustrations of previously. And just on the point of the anthem, we were really, really high up behind the goal that Robson-Cardew scored in. And we had sort of French, you know, local people who'd obviously got tickets for the game. And I mean, literally sitting behind me and behind us. And after the anthem, a guy tapped me on the shoulder, and he had very, very little English at all. And he just sort of tapped his heart And he did that kind of sort of classic sort of French thing of sort of kissing his fingers as if, like, you know, sort of, you know, bon appétit. And he essentially was saying that anthem was something special. And it was, and it'll never be topped. And you're absolutely right. It was perfect. The music was perfect. The timing, the pace. We were perfect as fans. It is one of the most... I mean, like, I'm feeling it now just talking to you and listening, dredging it back up. It is one of the most emotive and emotional moments of my life. And it is only football, and it shouldn't perhaps be that important, but it kind of is, isn't it? You know, that was just it, and everything
yeah, but,
kind of.
Yeah, Russell, with respect, I don't agree with you that it's only football. But, like, I'd wanted that all my life, just that one rendition of that anthem, which I thought we would never get. And then why I think it's not only football talks to that thing that you were mentioning earlier about, you know, are our players, is our country better known around the world, and that. And I think this is why it isn't only football, because we're on the western edge of Europe, we're patronised by a domineering, imperialist neighbour. Our language is sometimes marginalised, although on the whole, thankfully doing really well. And I think it gives us being in that tournament, gave us a chance to show what we're about. And for Wales to represent itself, not as part of Team GB, or not as an adjunct or as a function of some other power, but in our own right, as it, when we won that day, we started to realise, well, certainly once Toulouse happened, here we were, you know, and we were bringing it. We're confident and we're, you know, a relatively youthful, telegenic, media-friendly kind of crowd with us. You know, we didn't have black shirts and racists and trouble at the games, did we? We just had everyone in red looking like the happiest people in the world. I think that's why it isn't only football, because it gave us a cultural and opportunity to say, this is us, and we're proud of what we are, and we bring good things to the football side of things, but we bring even better things, arguably, to the cultural meeting and the way we're going to conduct ourselves in your country. Wales is separate and different. I'm not saying it's better than, I'm not making a really, in that sense, nationalistic point, but we are distinct, and we are so glad to be there, and so proud of what we've achieved, and so, frankly, incredulous. And another thing about that in Bordeaux as well, because by definition, there were some of us who'd been going 30 years. There were lots of young people who weren't alive, even, 15 or 18 or whatever. So, by definition, they hadn't been going long. Would there be antagonism by some of the old, so-called old-timers like me or, others, towards the so-called newcomers? No. And I remember vividly when we played Northern Ireland, by the way, that was for us, that was in the knockout stages of a major tournament. I just remember, like, we got a 6 o'clock Saturday morning Eurostar from St Pancras, and, like, the fact that I was having to do that at 4 o'clock in the morning, leave the house to go to see us in a knockout match, beyond dreams. But me and my two pals on the train, we were on a table with this woman, this is a younger than us woman, probably about 40. You could see she was Welsh, and she was going to the British, you could see she was like, oh, three blokes, are they going to be nice, are they going to be idiots, it's 6:30 in the morning. And then my mate gets out some posh vodka and all the ingredients to start making Bloody Marys, like, literally 6:30 in the morning. And you could see that, and she was in a bit more like, is this going to go all right? I remember her name was Beth then, and she was from Ynys Môn. She was like, oh, I'm really nervous because, well, her husband was somewhere else on the same train, anyway, because of seating, they were separated. Because I haven't been to many games, and are people going to be nice to me? And like, yeah, we were really nice to her, because she was a very charming and funny woman. I don't want this to sound like a Wales cliche, but quite quickly turned out that she knows Gary Pritchard, Blockroyd, who's one of my best pals as well. So Gary, because she works in the media, blah, blah, blah. So then that was it. Then there was just a party all the way to Paris. And when we got to Paris, she introduced us to her husband. And so it was that thing about, well, she was clearly, like, openly trepidatious about, would the day be all right? Would the fans be nice to her? Yeah, Russ, we won that game 1-0, becoming the first British team ever to win in the knockout phases of the European Championship. Don't know if you knew that. So I think Beth had a nice day, probably, by the end of that.
Don't know if I knew that. Come on, that's exactly the sort of nerdy stat that absolutely puts lead in my metaphorical pencil. And the lad I went out to Bordeaux with, Adam, that was his first Wales away game, which is not a bad start, I don't suppose. Quick shout out, the stadium as well was lush as well, wasn't it? As you kind of saw it from miles off. And it was, for me, because, you know, we just get inundated with this stuff with the internet and TV and globalisation and all the rest of it. And social media, you know, you can find an impressive stadium within 4 seconds on your phone. But actually, it's a while since I've had a wow factor in person. And we pulled up to that stadium and it was, wow, this is a bit different. This is impressive. And like you said, everything you said about walking up onto the concourse and then up into the stand and seeing the pitch, it was astonishing.
Another thing about that exact split second is what you were saying about Italia 90 earlier, because I turned to my friend and said, it looks like a stadium in the real finals like you see on telly. Mm. That's what I said to him, that's the inarticulate way I put it. But when you see the glamour ones from, I don't know, USA 94, Mexico 86, Italia 90, whatever, for me, Argentina 78, so that was my first World Cup. So when you see them on telly, and young Welsh kids, that's all we ever did see, and you just think, wow, that's impossibly glamorous, like playing football on the moon kind of thing. And then we were on the moon, and we were out of this world. It was just amazing.
Yeah. You mentioned your blog. Do you want to give another quick shout out to the link?
Yeah, well, it's pinned on my Twitter feed. So I did three articles, one about Moldova, one about Romania, and one about RCS when we played in Ostrava in 93. By the way, I'm never forgiven Ryan Giggs for that because I had a picture with him outside the ground as a callow 19-year-old youth, him, not me. And he blinked, and it was in the days of disposable cameras that you used to take to boots to get developed. So you couldn't do a second take or you couldn't edit it, and he blinked. So, yeah, good luck with the job, Giggsy. Yeah, so it's on Ralph Davis's, Ralph Davis's blog, actually, which is a Czech, based in the Czech Republic, called Blansko Kurblasa. Yeah, people can look that up. You can maybe mention how to spell it. So I put those three out recently. Well, one, because I found them, but two, to tap into that nostalgic, not saying it was better in those days, but just how brilliant it was in those days and how different it was. And by the way, look how far we've come kind of thing. So it's tapped into the zeitgeist a little bit. I think a lot of people have been commenting on that, can we do some more of that? So I'll be doing some more writing on that as well. So watch this space.
And you did touch on it earlier, and I was going to ask you it then, and you went off on a different tangent. But when you're going back and reading those, is there a different kind of perspective on, if not necessarily the trip itself, some of the more sort of cultural aspects of it? Does it dredge up different memories? Do you look at things differently now with the hindsight of what might be, what, 20, 25 years worth of hindsight?
One thing that quite struck me is I didn't really mention much about the football in those reports. It was more about the stuff going on around it. So, I mean, like in Romania, we lost 5-1 and we were 5-0 down after 34 minutes. But I was more interested in the fact that there was no away end. They made us sit in the middle of the Romania fans with the Wales under 21 players who were not impressed. And I was sitting behind Nathan Blake. And and we basically got bricked for 2 hours by locals. So, I mean, a lot of those places were quite rough. Yeah, as you said earlier, the football was incidental. But what I liked was the whole notion of going to weird faraway places, like when we went to Albania and we chose a weird route to get there by ferry from Bali to Durres. And it was hard. I mean, it was really ramshackle in Albania. I'm sure it'll be nicer. Or this town we're playing in now, I haven't heard of that town. So, but I can see why a lot of people now are still interested in going to those places. And there's a couple of UEFA member nations that we haven't played ever. I think Kazakhstan's one of them. So there's a couple that are still the holy grail, even to people who've been to 40 or 50 of them. So yeah, I think that's what it's about. It's about going somewhere that you wouldn't normally see. You wouldn't probably choose to take your family on a 10-day package tour to Kishinev, would you? But Wales gives you the opportunity to do that. So I mean, especially when it was like the end of communism and all, maybe those places have all become a little bit more much of a muchness now, or more, you know, more a bit like Western Europe. But in those days, it was about almost literally like seeing a different world.
Yeah.
And by the way, making us realise that, you know, how lucky we were to come from where we came from kind of thing.
I'm going to put myself on the spot here. So, yeah, Kazakhstan we haven't played. We haven't played Lithuania. We haven't played Kosovo or Gibraltar because they're newer nations.
Gibraltar, yeah.
I think that's the four. There might be another one, but I'm struggling to think of it.
No, I think that might be it, mate.
Yeah. Still got it.
So those ones are left, but then people just like going to these weird places, don't they? So I can see what the allure of a friendly in Albania in midweek in November. I can see why people are up for that, because they never go there otherwise, right? So yeah, that ended up being one of my favourite for various reasons, really. One, because I had a row with Bobby Gould, for obvious reasons, even though I had my arm around him, for less obvious reasons. Two, because Sean, one of the Wales fans who comes from Trebeau, chose to dress as Norman Wisdom for the whole week in full costume and walked around the middle of Tirana 24 hours a day for a week, doing Mr. Grimsdale impressions of Norman Wisdom, and literally had a crowd like the Pied Piper of Hamelin following him round town. I mean, look, in Trebeau, maybe that's just how they dress, but yeah, it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. So just, it's just like random stuff that happens when you're away from home, there's a big group of mates, and there's, you know, there's usually a drink has been taken by the time you get there. So it's just like random funny stuff happens. Even in San Marino in the first one, when, you know, they had a 100-strong football match, North Wales against South Wales, and I think that was when Billy Jones maybe nicked one of those police Vespa things. Yeah, just funny things, really.
That should be recreated, shouldn't it? Big North versus South. Who did the people from Aberystwyth? Which team were they on?
Oh, I've had this debate. Don't start me on that. Vanessa talking about is it North Wales? Oh my God! Anyway, can we just say it's Wales? Because all this North Wales, South Wales. Anyway, it's definitely in Wales.
Yeah. So you weren't on the North Wales side, coming from Taswell, no? Just to be clear.
I was definitely in the Huntoo side.
Yeah.
There was a lot more trouble in some of those places. Like, I remember in Ostrava, notoriously rough industrial town, probably, maybe a bit like Middlesbrough, maybe, up near the Polish border in Czechoslovakia had just broken up then. So, yeah, I think they deliberately put us in the biggest dump of a place they could find. They were just, like, running battles throughout the whole match. But it's all a bit surreal looking back on that now. But different times, mate. Terry Oz gave us tickets outside and said, thanks for coming. We got a draw, Mark Hughes scored. Favourite Wales player until Aaron Ramsey came along. Some of those games where we went and we weren't expecting a result, didn't really care, but I tell you what, when you nick a result, then half make it better as well. So,
yeah.
And it was just hard to get everywhere. Everywhere was decent schlep, so made it all the more fun when you got there. Or when we went to Azerbaijan, and I think in the first Azerbaijan game when we won 2-1, I think Gary Speed scored. And I think we were the first British team ever to have gone there.
Yeah.
A lot of us who went, that was one of the best ever trips, because we holed up in this bar in the middle of Baku, which was run by an English landlord, actually. And he said, oh, I'd always dreaded Azerbaijan tour in England, because England might turn up and just, whatever, cause trouble. And he was so glad when it was us. And, you know, we didn't take many, but we just thoroughly embraced it, put it that way, and had a brilliant time. So, yeah, it's that thing about going away, representing, and, yeah, being an ambassador for your country.
Yeah. What's next for you? Have you got your next trip lined up? Are you doing the Mexico game?
No, I can't get that far. I'm trying to work out Denmark. I probably won't go to Albania. And then saving it for the qualifiers, to be honest. The rise of the women's team recently as well. We took the kids to see the women's team against England in Southampton a couple of weeks ago for the first time. And I think they really identified with that as well, not least because the players were really friendly to the fans and they got a draw against the odds and all that stuff, blah, blah, blah. So I think there's a thing about following that. And hopefully, if they can maintain their form and get into the playoffs, then probably looking into going if they manage to get through, which is still a long shot. I know that World Cup final is in France next year, so thinking about that. But I think that's another part of the feel-good factor about Welsh football at the moment, is it's not only about the senior men's team. You know, a lot of the junior teams are doing well, the women's team is doing really well. So they've kind of inculcated this feeling that it's, you know, it's broader than just kind of like the first 11 in the men's side of things.
Couldn't agree more. We touched on that, I mean, albeit very briefly in the last podcast, because we had touched on, Dan and I had gone down to Barry to watch the Sea International. And, you know, it was a terrific evening down at Jenner. And it's a bit of a hackneyed phrase. I kind of regretted it as soon as I said it, so I'm going to do it again. But I'd sort of said this rising tide lifts all ships metaphor, I think, is applicable, which frankly, you know, has been my criticism of like the Mark Hughes era. You know, it was all he was interested in was that men's team. And nothing beneath it, not even the under-21s men, let alone anybody else. And this notion that it's much bigger and broader than that, and not only is it bigger than that, that actually that's how it should be. You know, there should be, you know, we're talking about diversity and inclusivity amongst the fan base. Well, that's got to apply to on the pitch as well and within, you know, the representative teams. And so standards seem to be improving. You know, I'm sure there's a massive distinction between what's available to the women's team, and I'm sure there's still some work to do. But I was talking to somebody recently who was sort of saying how, you know, for Jane Ludlow, they've got professional players, but then there's also semi-pro players. within that women's team, and a lot of what they have to spend time on, or a significant amount of what they've got to spend time on, is trying to kind of help that blend within that camp environment. Begin to realise that actually there's still some way to go in the development of the women's game, which is fine, but actually there's something more there that a manager is having to attend to. It's not like these players are all full-time professional, well-paid, turning up in mint condition because they've got, you know, the best sports science at their clubs available to them and so on. And I was kind of really interested as to what kind of culturally that, you know, how that actually kind of happens and what the actual detail of that is. You know, I've got a daughter and I want her to have positive women role models of all different types across all different fields. I want my son to realise that girls aren't kind of rubbish, because he's a bit like that at the minute, as a 10-year-old, and that actually they can achieve, and they can be brave, and they can be gutsy, and they can be skillful, they can be creative, they can be tough. I want him to kind of know that. So I can't wait to get them down. Well, it doesn't help as the fact my daughter has absolutely no interest in football. But
well, I couldn't agree more, and I couldn't recommend it highly enough. So we went that night against England away in Southampton, and me and Hayley Evans, there's a Wales fan called Hayley Evans, and we'd been in contact with Southampton Football Club a lot in the months running up to the game, saying, will there be a Wales end? And they were like, no, we've never thought of that, why would we do that? And then we kept lobbying them nicely, you know, saying, you know, because lots of us are coming up from Cardiff, lots of people are coming from, you know, and we want to be together in the ground. So Hayley organised a coach for the people from Cardiff, and we did have a, you know, what more or less was a Wales block behind one of the corners. And my kids are both girls, right? And they live in England. And through sheer bloody mindedness, they loved it. Then there was like, 400 of us there, surrounded by 25,000 England. And, you know, when we went in there, I'll be honest, we expected that we might lose, you know, 2-3 or 4-0, but we put up a good show and have a nice time. And then it quite quickly became obvious, you know, Laura Sullivan, the goalkeeper, she's one of the part-timers. She works in an office. That's amazing, right? She's got a job, a normal job. She got really clattered early on in the game, you know, really heavily right in front of us. Then proceeded to have an absolute world-class performance. Then we had the injustice of Natasha Harding's over the line not being given. And then this real sort of thing started unfolding in front of our eyes, and this real backs to the wall, gutsy, highly organised, passionate, committed performance against a team, you know, probably second or third best in the world, probably, you know, favourite World Cup semi-finalists, potentially, and we never gave them an inch. We absolutely loved it. And so two girls there, my two girls, who are like 13 and 11, they were absolutely cock-a-hoop. So that team of semi-pros, or, you know, some of them being semi-pros, as you say, they haven't let a goal in 5 games. That's astonishing in itself.
Yeah.
And now we've got the run of 3 home games culminating in England, you know, on the end of August. Yeah, and I think, I really hope they get big crowds for that. And I know they're trying to, the first one's at Swansea, and they're trying to get the biggest crowd. I think the biggest crowd's just under 4,000, so, you know, with the groundswell and the higher profile that it's got, you know, let's make sure that we, you know, smash through that barrier. They're fans, just like the men players are fans of Wales. A lot of those women, they die for Wales, and they're so proud to be out there. It sounds like a cliche, but that night in Southampton, it was a privilege to be there. You know, Hayley's bus that she'd organised with 60-odd people on, you know, they stood at the back of that block as a stand, and they sang, like, non-stop throughout the game. This English woman came up to me outside and said, tonight, I wish I was Welsh, because if I was Welsh, I would have been up with you. Your fans were amazing. That's on a Friday night, and it also clashed with Cardiff City playing at home against Wolves. We took all those fans there, sang, and got rewarded with a performance like that from those women. It's absolutely amazing.
Terrific effort by Hayley, and everyone went down. June the 7th, Wales playing Bosnia, Herzegovina at the Liberty. I'm not sure the kickoff time has been announced, though, so yeah. I think it's good that you know, they're taking it to a, shall we say, a big ground. And I think then the onus is on the fans then to turn up and put the support in. It'd be great if you could get a record crowd. I agree with you. I think that'd be terrific. And yeah, see what the calendar holds. And I wouldn't mind taking the mini-tods down, actually.
The one that'll be tricky after that is, not to tempt fate on the Bosnia one itself, but then Russia, on paper, are stronger than Bosnia. So Russia probably are rivals for the playoff position if you discount the fact that we're still actually in contention, because we got a draw and took 2 points off England. We're still in contention for top spot, actually, with them to come to our place, whenever our place ends up being. So Bosnia and then Russia, and something's building, and I think they deserve us repaying their amazing efforts on and off the pitch by turning up.
Yeah. I suppose at this point then, Mark, I should probably reveal, we've got no date in the diary, but I've been corresponding with Laura McAllister, ex-Wales international. You know, people listen to us presumably will be familiar with her. She's going to be joining us for a podcast. We're going to be discussing all sorts of different things. So hopefully we can kind of pin that down in the next kind of 2 to 3 weeks, which I'm really kind of looking forward to, because she's been a big friend of the podcast previously. And I think has kind of written really, I think, really perceptively, but also in a way that challenges some orthodoxies. And I don't like to use the term establishment lazily, but there's an element of that kind of wanting to challenge some of those structures and some of those assumptions in what she's written about the impact of a successful national team can do for Wales as a country, both kind of politically, economically, culturally, and has challenged some of the orthodoxies that exist in Wales, which is something I'm kind of in a personal capacity kind of really interested in. But she was kind of making the comparison between, you know, the Welsh football team and sort of Commonwealth Games and being able to compete under your own banner. And I think it upsets the apple cart in how, certainly in some country like China, for example, how we do kind of politics and how we do economy in Wales, which, you know, might be kind of bigging up the achievements of people on the pitch. But it comes back to what you were saying about Bordeaux and how it was more than just the football, and it was kind of cultural, and it's about identity and all those kind of things. We talk about the game going kind of mainstream then in Wales in comparison to that underground movement or culture then in the 80s that you touched on when we first started. But I think it's genuinely fascinating that something as like football can actually potentially have these dividends for us as a country.
It's great that she's coming on, and I look forward to hearing what she says. But I mean, she's one of the most thoughtful and intelligent and reflective people in the public eye in Wales currently, across any genre, really. And I think what she was saying, well, after the European Championships, was our football team is the most powerful brand that Wales have, of any brand in Wales. So forget the tourist board or marketing us in this way, or, you know, castles or blah blah, whatever dated sort of cultural icons they used to market us. One, successful. Two, done with a smile on our face. Three, young and confident and proud, and frankly extremely good looking. who could fail to be seduced by the power of that brand? So the football's the biggest thing, and again, not to denigrate any other sports, but football is clearly played in more countries and has bigger reach than any other sport in the world. And then, of course, in the Commonwealth Games, and I think, you know, people were talking about this on Twitter, Gary Pritchard, Lockroyd was talking about this, that it was a bit disappointing the way the BBC covered the Commonwealth Games, certainly the way they sort of started wrapping it up and reflecting on it towards the end, because those games, that was Wales's, and I think Scotland as well, best ever performance in the Commonwealth Games. It's the only event where, or it's the only multi-sport event where Wales are represented in their own right, and you can see the pride, you know, that brings them. That was another one of my childhood fears, you see, that I would end up winning a gold medal in the Olympics, and it hasn't come true yet. And I would have to sing something that's not "Hen Hudson Haddai," and I would only have really tried in the Commonwealth Games, you see, to sing "Hen Hudson Haddai." But you can see the pride that the medal winners were taking from that. And a Barker, and I remember Geraint Thomas in the last Commonwealth Games. You know, that really iconic scene of him coming over the line in the road race with his arms up in the air, and the absolute, you know, moved to tears pride that he derived from that. You know, and he's whatever. Much decorated and multi-gold medaled across all kinds of different championships, but to do that in that red jersey with Cymru across his chest clearly meant a lot to him. So I think Laura's talking about, where does Wales go next? Where does the country of Wales go next in terms of, she's talking about Brexit and in shifting political sands and stuff. So we've got a real opportunity to be on the front foot, be confident in ourselves. I think we should, because I think, you know, we've got a lot of talent, we've got a lot of success, we've got a lot to offer. Frankly, we've got two languages. We've got a language that is not English, let's put it that way. So we've got an interesting cultural element to that as well for us to market and describe and be proud of. So yeah, let's have the confidence in ourselves to take it to the next level.
I agree. Hopefully people who have the influence and the authority and the power are listening to this. One of the other things that you've been involved in and kind of emanated from all of these trips to these far-flung Eastern European destinations was the Gaul Charity, or Gaul Cymru now, and you were one of the founding trustees. How did that come about?
So Gaul, before it was the charity that it is now, was founded in 2002. I think it had been a culmination of a few things, really. So, for example, the Albania game that we were talking about earlier, some of us are taking some stuff out to Albania as long ago as 95, you know, stuff like school supplies and computer equipment, because we'd managed to get in touch by ourselves with a school that was high up in the hills over, you know, outside Tirana, and it was you know, it was an hour's drive from Tirana in a 4x4. It was a pretty inaccessible mountain village. And when we got to the school, they knew we were coming, but no one had ever come to visit them before. And the main classroom of the school didn't have a roof, like literally didn't have a roof. Not, it didn't have a hole in the roof. It just didn't have a roof forced up. And it's quite a humbling experience. The teachers of that school told us, you know, that it was the best thing. And they weren't being polite. They were being just honest that it was the greatest day in the history of their school. It was the best thing that had ever happened to those kids because these, frankly, these strangers from Wales, and I'm sure they didn't really know where Wales was or what Wales was, brought them some stuff just out of generosity or just back in a hunch, really. So that was in 95, and then two of us carried on going away, and in Albania, I'll never forget, Duncan Jardine, who ended up being one of the founders of Gaul, his daughter, Stacey, had been going away with Wales since she was, like, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4. On the way back from Albania, local kids were diving into the water under the ferry that we departed on, diving for dollar bills, like $1 bills, not $100 bills. They were diving for a dollar under a full-scale ferry, like quite dangerous. And she said, and she must have been about 10 at the time, and she turned to me on the, you know, on the back of the ferry, and we, you know, we were friends, and so she was just saying, like, it's not really fair, is it? And this is what she'd learned as a 10-year-old kid. She said to me, I'll never forget, she said, look, Mark, I'm from Basleg, and these kids are from Albania. And why have we got so much in Wales, and they've not really got anything, have they? And it's kind of that thing about Wales Away is like a way of opening up your eyes and just seeing the world from a different perspective, you know, irrespective of the fact that Mark Pembridge scored and we had a 1-all draw. That wasn't really the main thing that she took away from that trip. She took away the fact that maybe we could give something back from the Gaul charity. So that was 95. And then in 2002, there were a few founding trustees, like Dylan Llewellyn from Pwllheli, Kerry Pritchard from Ynysmon, Neil Dimmock, who a lot of Wales Away fans will know, a legend from Llanelli, and maybe a couple of others as well. But we were the founding trustees, and we went to Azerbaijan, the first time we played in Azerbaijan. You know, and we'd organised some stuff like football kits and, you know, all kinds of equipment that you can think of and school supplies and stuff like that. You know, just basic stuff really. But out there, we went to some orphanages in and around Baku, and the orphanages would be called like Orphanage Number 12 or Orphanage Number 8. Quite sort of bleak names, you know, there's just a whole succession of these places. And, you know, there are places like that all across, you know, the former Soviet Union and elsewhere in the, you know, what we used to call the Eastern Bloc. And, you know, we went there and we had a kick around with the kids and, you know, we'd gone there to watch football. And these kids were, you know, they'd been abandoned by their parents because they couldn't look after them. And so, you know, they were institutionalized from a really young age. I think that was in 2002. That was because we'd realized, you know, I think the idea for Gaul had come literally from a trip to a Finland under-21s away game where, you know, Gary and Neil and Dylan had sort of hatched the idea, really. And it was the first time that we sort of formalised it in 2002. Since then, it carries on to this day, and people will have seen that they do charity fundraising all the time. And in fact, everywhere we go, Gaul does something with the, you know, a local charity. So even when we played England away, to show a friendly face of Wales, we don't come with hooligans or to cause trouble, to be disrespectful. We come to enjoy ourselves and you know, enrich the town in which we play and have a nice time. They've driven cars to Baku, they've driven to Georgia, I think, and, you know, I'm not involved in it anymore because of different commitments, but it's been going well, coming out for nearly a couple of decades now. So that's a testament to the people who've carried on doing it. One, their attitude and their desire to give something back, but also to their hard work and to the support that, like, the Wales Away fan base has given them broadly and generally across those whatever 16 or 18 years. So I really hope that people can carry on supporting Gaul and getting involved with him, you know, even if you've only got a little bit of time to give, or if you've got some contacts that can help to get some stuff in. You know, that's something we should be really proud of, that we've achieved, like the whole of Wales fan base have achieved together, you know, just through wanting to give something back above and beyond just us enjoying ourselves at another football match.
It was podcast number 49. We spoke with Tim about the charity and he explained a little bit more about the history of it. And I mean, at that point, I think it was just before the game in Dublin. And so they were going out, I think, to a children's hospital there, and just explained some of what they were going to be doing there. If I was to be talking shop now, charity, voluntary community sectors, you know, is what I know, is where I work. And charities don't run themselves. They take a lot of commitment and hard work and dedication. And so all credit to the people involved, all credit to the people for founding it, because it's a terrific cause. And I think one of the things that Tim spoke quite passionately about in that podcast we did was about how part of it was also trying to change the perception of football fans, possibly from Britain, from the UK then, let's say, wanting to cause trouble, wanting to cause menace. And it was about sort of, like you say, just trying to sort of say that, you know, we can be friendly, we can be respectful, and we come to want to give something back and to leave a kind of a positive mark of us from Wales. And, you know, it can be anybody from any country. And I know there's other, you know, fans initiatives of a similar nature from other countries, but Gould probably going around for one of the longest, I guess. So like you say, if anyone wants to get involved, I mean, we'll put some of the contact details up for Gould again on this. I'll signpost back to that episode that we did with Tim as well. And, you know, they're always looking for ideas and people that run marathons. I mean, I'm not going to put my hand up for that, but, you know, other fundraising ideas. So all credit to you and the others for getting it off the ground. It's a terrific cause.
When we played in Belgrade and we lost 1-0 against Serbia and Montenegro, which I still blame on Mark Hughes, by the way, that's a different story. Yeah, the morning of the game, we went to a local orphanage there and we took on the kids and the resident there, like six aside in the playground kind of thing, partly for the benefit of the local media who'd come down and all that stuff. Yeah, they absolutely trounced us, these kids. They'd like ran rings around us. And I think they thought that was part of our charitable contribution, but actually we couldn't get near them, to be honest. So, yeah, we've been charitable in more ways than one.
Our dreadful record in former Yugoslavia extends to not just on the pitch, but in orphanages and children's homes as well.
Yeah, exactly. So not only the senior team, but in my case, the senior citizens team as well.
We've been going on for almost a Shaky-esque amount of time here, and I've still got to decide whether this will go out in one Ben-Hur style length single episode or whether we might put it into two, but that can be my headache. Can I put you on the spot and then, I don't know, give me a rundown maybe. Run so say, what's your favourite or what was your best Wales away trip? What's your top five in any order, if that's not putting you on the spot too much?
Clearly, I would stick what happened against Belgium in Lille. And the Wales performance that night in Toulouse is probably the most complete, swashbuckling, astonishing, attacking show of verve that I've probably seen from any international team in the history of the world, including Brazil 1970, certainly from any Wales team. So that night against Russia, although I didn't go to that for various reasons, but just even watching that remotely was astonishingly moving. I'll never forget my first away win. It was in Denmark in, I think, 99, when we won 2-1. Craig Bellamy, who not particularly tall, a bit like Shaky, rose in the last minute down our end to head an utterly implausible winner. That was one of the best nights of my life because I saw Wales win away, and that was something that I thought might never happen again, even though that was about my 12th game by then. So much so that a woman in the home stand behind us, a nice, respectable-looking woman, threw a whole pint of beer over me and told me to fuck off, which I was very proud of. And, that was an amazing night. Azerbaijan away, the first one when we won 2-1, just because it was a brilliant and weird place to go. I wouldn't have missed any of them for the world, to be honest.
That Denmark game is, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying, we scored two goals, but we only had one shot on target or something ridiculous.
So there was this bloke later on in the night in this bar, and he was just, every time he swore, I just got even happier. He kept going on to me, "You assholes! You Welsh assholes! You only had one shot. We had 100 shots. You only had one shot, you assholes." Honestly, every time we swore, I just got another drink. It was their disbelief at what they had seen before their eyes. It was an extremely one-sided game, but there we are. And Russ, to be honest, maybe this says something about me, but I'll also put up there as certainly the most lachrymose, tearful night of my life, and therefore one of the best ever trips of all time, was typically enough a 2-0 defeat, but it happened to be a 2-0 defeat in a small, quite ramshackle, provincial Bosnian town called Vinica on the 10th of October in 2015. Vinica will always be a legendary venue in the history of Wales football now, because that was a night when 700 of us crammed into a few seats and a bit of a corner of terrace in the pouring down rain, and we saw something happen that we never thought would happen and that we knew would never happen. And we qualified, and we qualified because of a goal elsewhere that we were informed of by Bryn Law standing in a corner and putting up two fingers and one finger, keeping us in touch that it was 2-1 in the Cyprus-Israel game. although we lost on the night, I spent the happiest few hours of my life, really, at that moment, crying in the car park behind the away end, standing in a muddy puddle, surrounded by police with various topless Wales away fans, Rhys Boar, with no t-shirt on, just crying, singing "I'm All Heed" to every camera crew that would give us time. So then it was probably the whole of our lives, really, had been a journey to that evening in that rainy, Balkan, ramshackle, beautiful stadium. So, yeah, then it's
alphabetically speaking, probably the last on the list of cities we've played in.
That was going to be one of my blogs, because my first game was in Brussels, so from Anderlecht to Zenica, so I did the full A to Z.
From A to Z. Oh, no, that's lovely. I love that. Done.
Listen, before you chuck me off, because the tapes run out, I just wanted to take a chance, really, to say thanks to some people, really. One is Shaky, who, by fluke, really, he lives about 4 miles away from me. We live in Hertfordshire. So over the last few years, I've been lucky enough and proud to become very good friend of his, and he can't get to as many Wales games as he would like because of his health situation, but he's one of the funniest and greatest people I've ever met, so I'd like to say thanks to him for that time that he's given me. With Shaky as well, I'm really excited that we've been talking about this project for quite a while. He's done a book about the history of Arseshirts, and takes a dozen or more iconic match-worn shirts from famous games in their history, and they turned it into this beautiful luxury coffee table book a year and a half ago, and it's absolutely beautiful. And yeah, we're working on a Wales version of that, taking Wales shirts from early 20th century right through to the China Cup, from players, match-worn, and each of them, quite apart from being a beautiful thing in its own right, each of them tells a story. A lot of books came out leading up to it in the wake of the European Championships because it's the greatest thing that ever happened in the history of mankind. And I think this will be a really sort of distinctive and worthy addition to that canon, really. It's gonna be a beautiful book. It's going to talk about the players, but talk about the significance and talk about, I was talking earlier about the journey that we've all been on and, where we've come from, which makes our current and recent success all the more beautiful. So it'll talk about the context, the history, and frankly, for those geeks and misfits and weirdos out there who are obsessed with Wales tops, me and you included, Russ.
Absolutely.
It's something you could easily lose a couple of jobs over. Weekends will go missing because you'll just find yourself gazing at this book and unable to take your eyes off it. So we're working on it. We've got great publishers in the pipeline, and he's got such an amazing collection of shirts that, frankly, it's an honour for me to be involved. And I think it's something that every Wales fan will really love. So we're working on it. We've got great publishers in the pipeline, and he's got such an amazing collection of shirts that, frankly, it's an honour for me to be involved. And I think it's something that every Wales fan will really love.
I cannot wait for that book. So, best of luck with that. Out before Christmas this year?
Hope so. We've got some other commitments as well, and, we're moving stuff around. So one thing we don't want to do is bring it out and not do it justice. So rather than saying now it's going to be out on the 31st of whatever month, we're keeping it to the... It's a one-off. It's unique. It'll be the most beautiful shirt book. It'll be probably one of the most beautiful football books that's ever been produced in the British Isles. So we're going to make it everything that it needs to be, and then it'll be out. Then you can get him back on in a 54-part podcast spelled right, talking about the minutiae of every page. You could probably talk about it for longer than the 58-year gap between our two major tournaments. We could fill the airwaves probably forever on that one. So.
My worry is there's not enough room in the internet for quite all of that, so we'd maybe have to sort of trim it a little bit. Yeah, and I think what's interesting as well, what I've picked up on, because I'm a bit of a nerd for kits and design and the aesthetic and stuff like that, but one of the things I've picked up on is the number of people who are interested in that general sense, and actually they expect interesting things from Wales kits. They've got no connection to Wales, they don't follow Wales or anything like that, but they expect, and conversely then they're disappointed when Wales kits perhaps aren't interesting. There isn't much of a talking point about them. So I think fans who are kind of obsessed about kits and kind of a bit nerdy about them, they do take a bit more of an interest in Wales than perhaps your average kind of nation because of that the historical value and merit that they've had over the years with, like, with Hummel and, you know, the 80s Adidas kits, obviously the Admiral one, but you know, but more recent ones as well. Yeah. You know, we've done any number of podcasts with Shaky, and you know, they're there, they're easily found. Looking both historically, looking specifically at Kappa, looking at the more recent ones, and he is a massive authority. And we end up kind of obsessing about, you know, the colour of the writing and, you know, something detail on a lapel or a cuff or something. And I love that.
Yeah. He could literally talk for Wales about you know, the detail of that. And even, you know, so we have a reputation, as you implied there, for quirky, world-class excellence, and through Hummel, through Admiral, through those Adidas ones. So some of the people have said, oh, some of the recent Adidas ones are a bit like, oh, straight out of the catalogue and bang a bag on it. But even some of them, so the European Championship one, become iconic in its own right, or will be some people's favourite kit, simply because of the association of what we did in them, contextualising it, putting it in broader sort of significance of why it's important. Yeah, and he's got forensic eye for detail that has his nearest and dearest, and me and Ralph, you know, people like that, shaking our heads with, you know, I thought I was off the scale geeky, but that boy, to be fair, like, he takes it to a whole new galaxy. So yeah, we're working on that book. It's going to be a beautiful physical item. It's going to be perfect. So it's the kind of book, there we are, the kind of book that we kind of wish someone existed or someone would write, therefore we're doing it ourselves. Yeah, we're really excited.
Cool.
Also, we spoke earlier on about the boy who left Lloyd's bank because he thought losing in Moldova was an infinitely better life choice. So yeah, Ralph has been there nearly every step of the way, and he's been to some games I haven't been to, so between us we've covered it all. So I'll give a shout out to Ralph. And finally, in the Euros, Ralph, I was lucky enough to talking about how the Euros brought together people who've been going a long time and not so long, and at the semi-final, actually, I was lucky enough to meet one of the friendliest and funniest and most full of life people I've ever met in my life. And sadly, he passed away recently, Clive Smith from Dow Life, and his son and daughter work at the FAW, and I'm friends with his daughter, Amanda. And when I met him, he was one of those people who you just wanted to be with because he was the life and soul of the party, and took me and Ralph under his wing, despite the fact that he hadn't known us very long. And when I was thinking of what to talk about tonight and go back across all those, you know, brilliant, fun experiences, you know, Clive's big smiling face was right there in the middle of all that. Yeah, I'd like to say thanks to him for making the European Championships even better for us.
That's absolutely fine. I'm pleased I can give you the platform to do that. Mark, it's been, I know we've been talking about doing this for a while and it's moved around the diary a few times, but I'm grateful for your time. It's been warm, it's been touching, final point, it's been funny, full of reminiscences, nostalgia. There's been some great memories, giving me goosebumps on a couple of occasions when you're talking about certain games and certain moments. Pleasure's been all mine. I hope people enjoy this. People who are familiar with you on Twitter, Chasing the Dragon without the A&S, obviously. Some of this will be not necessarily new to them, but they may not have never have heard you talk about it. And I think it comes across on your Twitter feed, the level of passion and commitment and effort that you've put into this and how much it means. But I think it's one thing reading tweets every now and again. It's another thing hearing it, you know, from the heart, which I think is very, very clearly where it's come from. And next time, let's do it in person and not over tinny speakers on my son's tablet. And hopefully this does all of that justice. I've got to think now whether we put this out as one big epic or in two parts, but that'll be my headache. But I can't wait to bring it to people's ears because there's some terrific stories there, Mark. And keep on doing what you're doing. And, you know, whenever you're there at some of these away games, you know, I don't get to anywhere near as many as I'd love to. You know, you're having the time of your life, that's clear. But there's other people willing you on and wishing you and vicariously being there through the likes of yourself and Ralph and Mark and all those others. And you mentioned any other names as well. Long may that continue, and just keep up doing what you're doing, really, because it's just a pleasure watching you and following you and listening to you and having the privilege of speaking to you.
Thanks, Ralph, and thanks for asking me to be part of this, because Podcast Android, I've liked the stuff you're doing since the start. So full power to you as well as you carry on with that.
Cheers. It does only encourage us, I'll be honest. So be careful what you wish for. But yeah, no, that's kind of you. And like I said, next time let's do it in person, yeah?
Cheers, mate. Take care. See you
nice soon. Nice one. Cheers. No star. Ta-da. La, 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 la.